You ain't heard nothing yet.
Turn around, little
bitch. What
am I going to do?
Frankly, my dear,
I'm going to make him an offer.
You talking to me?
No! I am not entertained!
I don't know who you are.
Why so serious?
When I'm good, I'm very good.
Simple.
But when I'm bad, I'm better.
He's a liar!
Snap out of it!
Call me Mr.
A boy's best friend is his mother.
You have no style.
You can bark all day, little dog.
No!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tinsel Factory. My name is Caitlin, and I'm your host. Hope everybody had a great week. I finally shut up for a couple of days to let my voice recover, if you can't tell. It's still not totally back, but I think we can all agree that I no longer sound like a Silver Lake slam poet who smokes six packs of cigarettes a day. I worked this week. That's pretty much all I did. But this episode actually comes out on a pretty exciting milestone for me. I've been calling it an anniversary, but I guess technically it's closer to a milestone. I've alluded to it over the years, but since this episode comes out on the day, and I'm also pretty stoked about it, given everything else that's been going on. But this episode actually releases on my 10-year anniversary of me being in remission from cancer, which is pretty cool. Also, last week's episode, totally forgot because, you know, I sounded like how I sounded. Last week was actually the 4th anniversary of this podcast, which is also pretty cool. I hit like 100,000 somethings that like on the, almost exactly on the day, I think, of like the anniversary of this podcast because it coincides with my anniversary of when I moved to LA. And yeah, I'm just so glad I don't sound stupid anymore. Well, no more than normal. This week on Movie Theater Movie Reviews, we've got Alien Romulus. Now, as of writing this, I mean, I feel like I've been doing this long enough where there was at least another Alien movie out, but I couldn't tell you what it was. But I've admittedly only seen, I've only seen the Alien prequels, so like Prometheus and Alien Covenant. I've seen the original Alien. I've seen half of Aliens, which is the second one. But for some reason, every time I keep putting it on, I keep falling asleep because I want to watch it. But I do not seem to have gotten my desire to watch movies mood back yet. So it's been a bit of a slog. And then, of course, I've seen the Alien versus Predator cinematic classics. So I'm not the most like up on Alien lore. I learned this past week there's quite a bit of it, but I enjoyed this movie. If you don't know, Alien Romulus takes place after the original Alien, but before the second Aliens. So it was perfect for me because that's all I've seen. I've not seen anything else. I thought it was really great. It felt very fresh given like how old of a franchise this is. This one, it's like, I think early 80s is when the first one, maybe 1978 when Alien came out. So it's been around for a long time, but this felt fresh and new. The actors were fantastic. I didn't know any of them, but they were great. Yeah, it's just another one of those that I think you should go into as blind as possible. I think that's just horror movies in general. Between how I felt and the people I know who have seen it, the general consensus is that it's one of the best Alien films ever. I've had a few people who I know have seen it say it's probably second for them to Alien. Not to hype it too much. I don't have an emotional attachment to these movies so much, but that is kind of the consensus, at least in my life. And then the Criterion pick of the week is part of Spine 1194, which is 1925's The Mystic. And it's directed by Todd Browning. We're going to talk about him a bit today, as he was a frequent collaborator of our subject this week. But this dude made some crazy ass movies back in the day, and The Mystic is no exception. It is on the tamer end compared to what he did later. But it's a good, I've seen about a handful of his movies. This was the earliest of his, I think, that I've seen, 1925. I've seen more of his, like some of his sound work. So obviously like 30s and above, but he used to be like a carnival barker, not to repeat myself because I am going to say that later in the episode, but like a lot of his work revolves around the circus. This one does. It's interesting to see like a movie about 8 years before the one I've seen of his the most, which is Freaks, to see the starting points of like his style. I guess it's not probably starting points, but like as it developed and then eventually reached Freak. I am fully rambling. I'm just so glad I can talk. You can find this film in pretty decent condition on YouTube. It's not terribly difficult to find. Not a reputable source, but it also is a 99-year-old movie, so I wouldn't worry too much about pirating it. Everybody's very dead, and there's no residuals from movies before like 1941, so you're safe there, so pirate away. Until fairly recently, this movie was actually pretty widely forgotten because it's one of his earlier works. But Browning's fascination with the weird is on full display in this movie, and everybody kind of sucks as a person. Like, there's not really a good person in this movie in a way that you don't really see in films of this era, especially after like the Hays Code went into effect a few years after this movie came out. So it's very of its time. It's, you know, there's things that have not aged well, just to give you a heads up, but it was good. And now on to this week's topic. This week, while he's most often remembered for his horror film roles, this actor was a force to be reckoned with in any genre he dipped his toes into. This week, the man of 1,000 faces, Lon Chaney. With that, let's take our places. It's showtime. Leonidas Frank Chaney was born in Colorado on April Fool's Day, 1883, the son of a barber named Frank and a mother named Alice. Lon's maternal grandfather, Jonathan Ralston Kennedy, founded the Colorado School for the Education of Mutes, which is still there but has a more modern name. It's a school for the deaf, in 1874, and Chaney's parents met there as they were both deaf. As anyone who has ever taken a sign language class can tell you, Lon learning to communicate through sign language and just how deaf people like punctuate their signing made him very, very adept for his eventual film work. I took sign language in college. If you don't know, your face is kind of used as punctuation marks to give subtext when you're signing, because obviously you can't hear tone for obvious reasons. So you use your face. So you get very adept at like using your face for certain things. Your eyebrows mean certain things when you move them. The shape of your mouth means other things. And those are just the ones I'm remembering off the top of my head, like 15 years removed. Oh God, I'm old. From last time I just took a sign language class, I still can sign. I still can communicate with it, but not as good as I was back then. Basically, Lon having to communicate with his parents that way, he develops something that people, and I've heard this before, have called deaf face. I'm sure that's not the PC term anymore, but this guy's been dead a very long time, so not a lot of sources using the PC terms. But it's basically just the way your face kind of, the way your muscles develop in your face because you're using them a bit more than the average person. So Lon having that would serve him very well later in his career. Lon would look back on his childhood as an overall happy one, but it wasn't without its trials and tribulations. Though not deaf, he was raised by nonverbal parents and therefore did not develop a verbal language until later in life than is average. When he was 9, Lon had to drop out of school after his mother became ill. As the eldest child, he was also responsible for the well-being of his 2 younger siblings. The husband left at some point, but I couldn't get a solid year. But based on the sources I used, it was obviously before this. Lon's mother had developed rheumatism, which also made it impossible for her to sign, which means it rendered her unable to communicate efficiently with her family. So not great. Later, Lon worked several odd jobs before turning to acting at age 19 when he appeared in a play he co-wrote with his brother. One of the earliest reviews of his performance would praise his comedic timing and dancing abilities. After a few years of touring with the show to moderate success, Chaney met actress/singer Cleva Creighton in 1905 in Oklahoma City. He was 22 and she was 15-16, depending on the source. The two married and toured together with their son, who was born in 1906, whom they named Creighton. You'll likely know him better by his stage name, Lon Chaney Jr. He was born 2 months premature and not breathing. According to Lon Jr., his father dunked him in a freezing lake, which revived the newborn baby. While Jr. got stronger, they obviously couldn't travel with a sick baby. Lon worked in a furniture store in Oklahoma to support his new family. That family eventually settled in California after years of touring in 1910. Cracks were beginning to form in the marriage due to ebbs and flows in each other's careers and also flirtations with members of the opposite sex. Cleva worked as a cabaret dancer and Lon as a choreographer, amongst other things. So two jobs not great to have if you have a partner prone to jealousy, because there's a lot of flirtation and handling and touching that has to happen in both of those professions. And for the cabaret stuff, definitely flirting. In addition to the choreographer stuff, Lon also found more steady work not only as an actor, but also as a stage manager. This gig was going to require him to travel, which meant leaving his family behind, and Cleaver refused to be in charge of their son solo. Everything came to a head in 1913 when Cleaver attempted suicide. She swallowed mercury dichloride, which burned her vocal cords, from what I can tell, and ended her singing career. Lon divorced her and never spoke to or about her again, which caused a massive scandal in the theater community. This forced him out of theater work. He was basically blacklisted from that community, so he kind of was forced, if he wanted to continue acting, to go into motion pictures. Lon made his debut in motion pictures in 1912 at Nestor Pictures, which was the first permanent film company to settle in Hollywood, per my sources. Not much is known about Lon during his first five-ish years in the motion picture business, but we do know that is when he first had a contract at Universal. It likely went the way of most actors at this time. He appeared in whatever films were thrown his way, with very little say in what he did. What set Lon apart from other actors, though, was his makeup skills. This skill with makeup, his kit at this time was a humble little metal lunchbox, slowly but surely netted him more and more work. In his downtime, he would experiment with looks and have them photographed to see what would work on camera versus what it looked like in reality. There's always a little bit of a discrepancy. This ran the gamut from just different kinds of dudes with like facial hair to the monsters he'd eventually be best remembered for. Unfortunately, most of these looks only survived via photographs that Lon sent to his family back in Colorado, as Universal destroyed much of the film stock for its silver, which was unfortunately a relatively common practice at this time at all of the studios. That's why we don't have a lot of people's silent work. During this time, Lon befriended the husband-wife director team of Joe DeGrassi and Ida Mae Park, who gave him more substantial roles in their pictures and further encouraged him to play macabre characters that required the makeup. In all, they'd make 60 films together, with many as Lon playing some kind of monster or disfigured individual. Lon would also dabble briefly in directing and writing, but these jobs weren't a good match for him, so he kind of just let that go. In 1915, Lon married one of his former colleagues from one of the theater companies he'd managed. She was a recently divorced chorus girl named Hazel Hastings. The new couple gained custody of Creighton, who had resided in various homes and boarding schools since Lon's divorce 2 years prior. Overall, perhaps because the early public scandal in his career kind of scarred him, makes sense, Lon Chaney would be pretty private about who he was as a person, preferring to disappear into the characters he played. Very little is also known about Hazel, but by all reports, the two had a very happy marriage. By 1917, Lon had become one of Universal's biggest talents, but did not have the salary to match. When he asked for a raise and a new 5-year contract, a studio executive replied, quote, "You'll never be worth more than $100 a week." So he left. Lon struggled to get work for the next year or so until he played a large role in the now mostly lost William S. Hart film Riddle Gone from 1918. This role garnered Lon the industry recognition he needed to become a major character actor in town. Arguably the first character actor in Hollywood. This recognition would also land him back at Universal, working with director Todd Browning. Browning, like I mentioned at the top of the episode, he was a character. He was a former carnival barker turned visionary whose films are just as unsettling today as they were over 100 years ago. Browning and Lon's first film together was 1919's The Wicked Darling, in which Lon played a pickpocket. 1919's The Miracle Man, which he did for famous players Lasky, Paramount, would be the first film that gave Lon his big, big break. In the film, Lon played one of several con men trying to make money off of a series of miracles, quote unquote, done by a blind faith healer. In the film, Lon pretends to be a handicapped beggar who is, quote unquote, healed by this blind man. famously, Lon's movements while being healed, they're very jerky and awkward and kind of very, very like monster in a horror movie, like Samara coming out of the TV type stuff. Those movements while he was being healed were so frenetic and jarring for that era that rumors of him being a contortionist or double jointed ran rampant. You can still find it cited in some places, but in reality, dude was just a real good actor who had been honing his craft for about 15 years. That's also a thing that can happen. While the Miracle Man garnered Lon a boatload of acclaim, he still wasn't made a leading man, and the wild roles continued. One of Lon's next films after The Miracle Man was 1920's The Penalty, which stirred up a ton of controversy due to its graphic scenes, which included depictions of like drug addicts, naked ladies, and murder. In the film, Lon plays a legless man that tries to get another man's legs to graft them onto what's left of his own. Lon achieved the look of being a legless man by walking on his knees and strapping his calves to his thighs. There are no trick shots in this film to hide the rest of his legs. Just some tricky costuming to kind of hide the fact that like there's feet sticking out of the middle of his back or out of his butt or whatever. However long his legs were. I don't know how tall Lon Chaney was. The pain apparently to get this look was so intense, unsurprisingly, that Lon could only remain strapped up like this for about 10 to 20 minutes. I'd be doing that for no minutes whatsoever. So kudos to this dude. I've seen clips of it from like stuff I watch, but I am going to try and watch this, if not this afternoon, tonight, because I live a crazy single LA life like that. But it looks unsettling as hell, and I'm very excited. It's on Tubi for the US listeners or anybody with a VPN, and it appears to be in pretty good condition. Like, it seems to be a pretty good scan from just the first couple of minutes I watched to make sure it wasn't shitty. And yes, this is also a Todd Browning film. It's just, oh my God. I'm really excited for this. It's weird being excited over watching a silent film, but that's the life I've chosen for myself. While this film didn't set the world on fire due to some pretty egregious mistakes made in pre-production, mostly the fact that they hired an unprepared director, the film The Trap from 1922, which Lon did for Universal, was the first to carry a tagline that featured the moniker that would follow Lon to this day, which is the Man of 1,000 Faces. One of Lon's next major roles was also in 1922, in which he played Fagin, the haggard adult leader of the child gang, in an adaptation of Oliver Twist. The film starred Jackie Coogan right off of his The Kid success, if you remember him from the November 2023 episodes. He's basically the first child actor ever. And Lon's skills as not only an actor, but as a makeup artist are on full display. You would never know it was Lon Chaney unless you're like, hey, that's Lon Chaney. Or, you know, the credits. If you watch the credits, you'd probably know. After The Trap and another film featuring Lon called The Shock failed to generate decent box office for Universal, the studio's owner Carl Laemmle threatened the film's producer, Irving Thalberg, that if he made another disappointing film for the studio, he'd be out on his ass. Lucky for Thalberg, he had the perfect next vehicle in mind for Mr. Lon Chaney. Well, it might have been his idea. While Thalberg has historically gotten the credit for coming up with the idea to make an adaptation of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, paperwork has proven that while, yes, he put in the work, it was actually Lon and his people that had started putting the film together. Back then, as it is now, it was not unusual for actors to seek out their own projects to bring to studios in addition to what the studios would bring to them. In this case, it appears that Lon brought this project to Universal. The film would feature an utterly unrecognizable Lon, who went all out for his look for Quasimodo. This dude looked nothing like the Disney character, so if that's what you're picturing, don't. He had a protruding, like, milky eye. He had hair on the backs of his hands and all over his body, like when they do the whipping scene. And he's definitely done something to his cheeks because they're very, very prominent. This, of course, is in addition to the padding he had to wear to have the hunchback and, you know, the way he had to, like, move his body. But the makeup look just itself took 3 hours each day, and unsurprisingly, super uncomfortable. Production took nearly every light in Hollywood for its night scenes and featured a replica of Notre Dame that was recreated on the Universal backlot. The film, upon its release, cemented Lon as Hollywood's premier character actor. Always a bridesmaid. While a very private person, what is known about Lon as a man is that he was a very giving individual. He was known to have advocated for his crews and even once famously gave advice to an up-and-coming actor named Boris Karloff, who he drove home from set one day. When Thalberg went to MGM, he took Lon with him, and he starred in one of the studio's earliest successes, dressed up as a creepy-ass clown who gets revenge on those that did him wrong. The film was called He Who Gets Slapped, which is also on my list, and it's actually about a scientist, played by Lon, who is hoodwinked by the rich patron who funded his research, who claims the discoveries that Lon's character made on the origins of mankind as his own. He humiliates Lon's character by slapping him in front of all his colleagues, so naturally he joins the circus as a clown and ultimately goes after the Baron who stole the credit for his life's work, dressed as a fucking clown. Again, I gotta double check. I haven't done the Letterboxd thing yet. I'm pretty sure this one is still around, but if not, the clips, my goodness. Lon then appeared in a film called The Unholy Three, once again with Todd Browning at the helm. While not made up to the nines at all times in this film, or really at all, Lon is still unsettling as Echo, a ventriloquist, but also he plays an old woman with Lon Chaney jawline. Like, he looks like an old woman, but you're like, that's Lon Chaney dressed as a woman. Well, probably his most famous film, the production of 1925's The Phantom of the Opera was a tense one. He and the director, Rupert Julian, had very different ideas as to what they wanted the Phantom to be. Eventually, the two refused to speak to one another, so there was a carrier pigeon system put in place to relay messages. Julian's directions would be given to Lon, who responded, quote, "Tell him to go to hell," and then Lon did what he wanted for the scenes. While Julian had been directing for years and had just done a major solid for the studio in finishing the 1923 film Merry-Go-Round after the film's original director was fired, it was evident to everyone on the Phantom set that Julian was just not ready to direct this prestigious of a movie, or with a star as big as Lon Chaney. Once again, Lon is unrecognizable in this film, save for the way he moves through a scene. If you watch enough of his stuff after a while, like with all the clips I've watched this week, there's definitely a certain like fluidity of movement that you start to kind of associate with how all of his characters move. By this point, his lunchbox makeup kit had evolved into basically an altered tackle box toolkit situation. I think it's technically a toolkit, but there's like all the little cubbies, so it reminded me more of a tackle box. But yeah, it's advanced since then. He also had a wax figure of his face to build pieces on before slapping them onto his own face. But using his bag of tricks, Lon stuffed cotton into his cheeks to raise his cheekbones, a skull cap to hide most of his hair and to make his forehead appear larger. He glued his ears to his head and then painted the area around his eyes black, but added white highlights under his eyes to make them appear more skeletal. Then he attached prongs to a set of rotted false teeth and coated his lips with grease paint. Lon then used putty to sharpen the angle of his nose and inserted two loops of wire into his nostrils to basically pull his nose up, and the wires were hidden underneath putty. According to the film cinematographer Charles Van Anger, who was also the carrier pigeon on set, Lon had a hell of a time with all of this and would sometimes bleed profusely from the shit he'd done to his face to look like the Phantom of the Opera. These accounts are disputed, though. Some people say, like, no, he was good at it. It didn't bother him. But if so, where's this guy remembering all the blood coming from? Images of Lon done up as the Phantom were not allowed to appear on any of the marketing materials, as Lon wanted audiences to experience the look for the first time in the theater. So in early marketing materials for this film, it's just the outline of his head, which is blacked out. Legend has it that when audiences first saw the movie, many people screamed or fainted during the scene when the Phantom's face is first revealed. This look is also considered to be the most accurate depiction of the Phantom based on the description from the novel. He did not look like Gerard Butler in the novel. While the film is almost universally considered one of the most important horror films ever made, at the time it was actually met with mixed reviews, but did pretty okay box office-wise. It's always weird when you, like, you know, films that are just like a staple of like the whole thing, recommended, required viewing, and then you hear like at the time they're like, eh, it's fine. For the second time in his career, Lon played a Chinese man, this time a 100-year-old Mandarin man in the film Mr. Wu. Actually, he played the old Mr. Wu, but also he played his grandson. So yeah, that happened. For the makeup, Lon spent an insane amount of time trying to get the look right without it being offensive. Don't get me wrong, it's still not okay by modern standards or really ever standards, but you know how people were. But his depiction of an Asian man is far less offensive than, say, Mickey Rooney's in Breakfast at Tiffany's. It's at least nuanced. It's still not a fun thing to look at, but you also just have to acknowledge the time and be grateful that doesn't really happen anymore. Now they just whitewash things. After making a name for himself as this chameleon, that man of a thousand faces, Lon made a film sans the makeup, in a way proving that yes, he could do all this cool shit with makeup, but also he was a real good actor. 1927's Tell It to the Marines shows Lon basically just as himself, or looking like himself, I should say, as a hard-ass Marine with a heart of gold. The film was the first Hollywood picture to be shot with the cooperation of the Marines, and Lon was made the first actor to become an honorary member of the U.S. Marine Corps. People who knew a Marine in their life would remark that Lon's performance reminded them of their loved one, and just in general, he got very high praise for this film. Lon loved his work and his performance in this movie, so much so that its premiere was one of the few times that he and Hazel stepped out together to basically be Hollywood people. Lon hated the whole Hollywood scene. He had no use for it, really. He was just there to work and then go home to his family. After playing a character with no legs, how about no arms? In 1927, Lon played Alonzo the Armless, a circus performer who throws knives with his feet. This time, Lon needed some assistance and worked with a real armless double named Paul Desmuke, who used his legs and feet to move all the objects like the knives and the cigarettes, while some camera trickery made Lon's upper body and face appear on the top. In one scene, he also smokes a cigarette using his toes, like his double's toes, which like makes it icky when you realize that's what's happening. He's just smoking a cigarette between through somebody else's toes. I don't know. It made me laugh. It's really funny to see knowing that, like, if it's your own toes, I guess fine. And if they're your hands, but it's just knowing that that's just some dude's feet he's smoking a cigarette out of just made me laugh. This film also features Joan Crawford, who was 18 at the time, in one of her first major roles. And there's a fun little twist in that one, but I won't spoil it for you. It's got a very tragic ending for Lon's character, a very ironic tragic ending. Now, most of, like I said, Lon Chaney's films are lost because of poor storage or breaking down the film to get the silver. If we have a third of his films, I think it's just barely. But the most sought after of the lost Lon Chaney films is easily London After Midnight from 1927. The last surviving copy of the film known to exist was reportedly lost in an MGM vault fire in 1965. It's kind of similar to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but it was actually based on a short story written by Todd Browning. Lon plays a professor, but also a character known as the vampire. And as the vampire, Lon had these like sharp teeth, long hair. He had like a top hat on his head. He looked like Dr. Jekyll, but with like shark teeth. And he like moved around at a crouch. You've probably seen a lot. If you know Lon Chaney at all or his work, you probably have seen this image. He's got like really manic eyes. I did not know this film was lost just because of how often images from this movie come up when dealing with Lon Chaney. But yeah, this movie doesn't, there's no known surviving copy of this film. Oh, and then I went on a tangent. He also used wires around his eyes to get that really wide, deranged look. So he basically clockwork oranged his eye sockets. I'm also really curious now, that just popped in my head, how the wires in makeup worked back then. I gotta figure that out because it doesn't sound great. Also, I'm probably thinking of the wrong kind of wires in my head. Anyway, while those who were interviewed about London After Midnight who had seen it, they remember the film as just okay, but the film kind of has like an infamy status because it was actually blamed for a murder, or one man tried to blame it for a murder. There was a dude in London that claimed he was so terrified by Lon Chaney as the vampire that he ran out of the theater and killed a woman in a fugue state, like in a fit, as you do. Unsurprisingly, this defense was not accepted by London lawyers, London court. He did not get away with that claim. Lon's final silent film was 1929's Thunder, which is a mostly lost film that saw Lon playing a no-nonsense train engineer, aptly named Grumpy. While working on the film, which required location shoots in Greenway, Wisconsin, the transition from the balmy California weather to the frigid winter weather of the Midwest wreaked havoc on the actor's body. Lon caught a cold on the way to Wisconsin, which developed into walking pneumonia. Now, Lon was a workhorse, so he tried to kind of power through it, but it got too bad. He had to miss several days of work and ultimately got so sick that production had to like briefly shut down. Like, he was messed up. Shooting did resume. Obviously, the film was completed and released. But what the crew and cast didn't realize was just how sick Lon Chaney was. When sound arrived in the pictures, Lon, unsurprisingly, not a fan. He thought talking would ruin the mystery of the film-to-audience relationship. In 1929, when MGM did a sound review of all of their talent, only Lon Chaney and the Swedish-born Greta Garbo were the only stars not to take part in it. The review did feature an homage to his work, however. There's a song and sequence about Lon Chaney and all his different faces. I tried to pull the song. I could not find it in a way that I could rip for the podcast, unfortunately, but know that it exists and it's a little bit of an earworm. Several of Chaney's films were reissued with sound at this time, including Phantom of the Opera, to capitalize on the new medium, but the Phantom did not speak in that film. Despite his very vocal oppositions to sound pictures, Universal was at the time pursuing him to portray Dracula in their upcoming production of that film. Instead, he got a huge bonus and new contract to stay with MGM. Lon's first sound film officially was a 1930s sound remake of The Unholy Three, the one where he was the ventriloquist and old lady. As an homage to his Man of a Thousand Faces title, his character was declared in the film to be the Man of 100 Golden Voices. And it ended up being a good foray into sound for Lon, as he played a character he'd already portrayed on film. He just had to memorize some lines this time. It's got to be easier to, while it's a new medium, it's a character and it's a story you're familiar with because you've already shot a version of it. So you're just adding one skill. He also had a decent voice and turned out he was super good at like vocal impressions and tricks. He could throw his voice like a ventriloquist could. And he was so good at it that MGM made him sign an affidavit confirming that all the five voices, I think it was, that he used in the film were all him because they were all so different. He definitely had the talent that could have transitioned into the era of talkies. Unfortunately, he would never get the chance to do that. While shooting the remake of The Unholy Three, Lon knew that he had lung cancer. He struggled through the production of the film, but few were aware of just how sick he was because he did his best to hide it. Less than 2 months after Lon's debut as a speaking actor released, he passed away. It was August 26th, 1930. So tomorrow, as of the release of this episode, coincidentally enough, is the 94th anniversary of his passing. He was only 47 years old and was buried 2 days later in Glendale, California. His grave is unmarked, but naturally people know where it is. While he was set up to be an actor with one of the longest careers in Tinseltown, Lon Chaney's life was cut tragically short. Looking at his work this week, I don't think there's ever been an actor that has come along since that has ever been able to fill the void he left behind. This man was a singular talent. He just had this natural charisma to be a star. He was just a very modest, quiet man who wanted to just work and be with his family. But he had this talent to make these larger-than-life fantastical characters. And luckily, what's left of his work is enough for him to forever be a legend of the silver screen. And that is going to do it for this week. If there's anything you'd like me to cover in the future, please reach out on social media where I post photos at Tinsel Factory Pod on Instagram, on Facebook at The Tinsel Factory, or you can always email me at tinselfactorypod@gmail.com. I'm starting to finalize what I want to do for my one-off episode this year. So if anybody has anything they'd like, shoot me an email. I have one suggestion that I don't hate, but if somebody comes up with something better, I'll do that. And I'll just keep pushing things down the line like I've been doing. I've got a Letterboxd account which features my watch list, film diary, and recommended viewing for this episode. You can check it out with the link in the show notes. I'm relying on word of mouth to get this podcast out there, so if you could please rate, review, and subscribe so that other people can find this podcast, that would be a huge help. In order to keep making the podcast, I've also set up a support page, the link of which you can find in the show notes. If you'd like to help out in any way, I'd very much appreciate it. I've also got the Buy Me a Coffee. I didn't do coffee this morning because I actually slept, and I'm doing this a little bit earlier because I've got a lot of shit to do today. I've also got merch. Check it out, the link in the show notes. Next month, we're going back on the road. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, that's a wrap.